but here was the thing, you know, and the snap decision that I had to make at that point, right? And all of this is going through my head is I'm like, I need to show them that I can do this. I need to show them that I am capable, and I need to show them that I belong here. That was on my left shoulder, and on my right shoulder was the voice of reality saying, if you go off the other side, it is, and I'm not exaggerating here, a 60-foot sheer drop. What good are you going to be with family, your loved ones, and your friends if you go off the other side of that rock and you die?
Like millions of people around the world, we need to work. Some do it for the money. Others do it for the recognition. And if you're lucky, you do it because you love it. But finding purpose and passion in your work can be easier said than done, and the path to success can be unpredictable at best. But if you're looking for some inspiration, then I've got one question for you. Are you consuming your career, or is it consuming you? Welcome to Consuming Careers. All right, let's be honest. Who among us hasn't felt like they were in way over their heads at some point? Well, on this week's episode of Consuming Careers, we're honored to have the incredible Lori Gray joining us. She shares her deeply personal journey through something many of us can relate to, imposter syndrome. Well, she's lived it, and she's come out the other side, and we're going to dive into her experiences, the physical and emotional challenges she's faced, and how she overcame them all. Well, Lori is also a renowned expert in the field of customer experience, and she shares her insights in that too. But hold on to your seats, because she's also going to take us for a ride through her adventures in professional rock crawling, and you do not want to miss that. So buckle up and let's jump into my interview with Lori. All right. Well, welcome back to Consuming Careers Podcast. So excited to have my guest, Lori Gray. Welcome to Consuming Careers.
Thank you so much.
And I caught you with a mouthful of pretzel. So
you did.
This is your fault, because you are you've served up some hot baked pretzels, homemade mead on your front porch.
Yes.
This is fantastic.
Yeah. And, you know, when we had talked about planning, you had said, what's somewhere meaningful to you? And I thought, well, I don't know where we go to a restaurant necessarily. Yeah. And so we were sitting on my front porch of a log cabin in the mountains in Georgia. I am looking at my beehives. The breeze is blowing through the trees.
This is nice.
Absolutely. I wish you could hear how quiet it is here.
Yeah. The spring weather is like, what are we in the, maybe in the 50s in a cool breeze.
It is.
And you got chickens in the back.
The chickens are in the back. The bees are in the front.
Nice.
Yeah.
So Waleska, Georgia, you'll have to look that up if you're not from Georgia, if you're not from this part of the country. Small town.
College town.
Yeah. Of Reinhardt University.
That's right. All 1,000-ish students. Mm. We're very proud of the fact that our downtown is simply a four-way stop with a flashing light. We have two gas stations, a Dollar General, a pharmacy, a veterinarian's office. I think there's a hair salon down there. What am I? Oh, a Subway. And a liquor store.
Okay.
Got the basics covered.
I saw that. Waleska Liquor.
Yeah, it's new.
Yeah, that's nice.
That was a big deal last year.
You know, funny thing, my daughter's looking at going to Reinhardt for her master's.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So we'll be able to tell that we saw it here first.
Crewston campus, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
They have those enormous trees. And every time I go by, I just wonder, how old are those trees? Because they are the biggest that I've ever seen. There's these giant oak trees. And, you know, that's something here as we sit here. I mean, we have the 15 acres, a little bit more than that here. And I would say all but maybe 2 to 3 of the acres are completely wooded. And so all of my trees, these are my trees.
Yeah, this is fantastic. And I haven't heard a car yet.
No.
And we've been up here for about an hour and a half touring, looking around. And you've been a wonderful hostess.
Well, thank you.
This is fantastic. So let's dig in a little bit.
Sure.
Can you just bring us up to speed? What are you doing now?
Like, so
what's going on?
I literally just started a new job last week with a software company here in the Metro Atlanta area called Seaboard.
Okay.
And it was an amazing job search experience. I worked with a recruiter from Synergist named Madison Jinks, who helped to introduce me to the hiring manager. And what's really exciting about this organization is that they're in the middle of transformation. The CEO actually came from Amazon and invented more or less Amazon Business. And
wow.
So I am super excited to get to work in the product context underneath that type of leadership. And so far, literally first weekend, everybody I've met is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. They are so excited about the concept of user experience. I have been assigned as the leader of a main work stream, a strategic work stream that the leadership team had put together at the beginning of the month, leading the user experience methodology for the organization.
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't set out necessarily to find a job with big responsibilities. I was really just looking more for a place where I could do some great work. And it looks like I've got the best of both worlds.
Nice, nice. And I was telling you earlier that when you say user experience, really up until 5 or 6 years ago, maybe I've heard that before, but I didn't know what that meant.
Sure.
Right. And so I didn't know if that was product-based or service-based. Can you just kind of, for the listener, just what is customer experience? What is the scope of it? Who does it touch? What's the value of it? Like, why should anybody care?
Sure. Yeah, no, I'll give you the spiel that I was giving my new colleagues this week. So if we look at the customer experience, it begins from the first time that somebody, a potential customer, realizes that there's an organization called CBORD out there.
Okay.
And it goes until the very last interaction that they ever have with that company. If it's the last keystroke, if it's the last login, if it's the last website search, whatever. And along the way, there are opportunities for the organization and the customer to interact. And I'll call those user experiences, touch points. Some of them may be digital, like working on the website, or interacting with our software, or some of them may be service-based. And there's a lot of nuance in this. You may hear the terms thrown around service design that really kind of covers that person-to-person experience. So in the case of a software company, this would be the implementation team and the support teams and, you know, follow-up interactions with the sales teams and different members.
Okay.
So, you know, what I would say is that there's the customer journey that goes from point A to point B in time. And then there are interactions or touch points that could be digital or service-based along the way. And that user experience is really what we're doing to craft the positive experience during those touch points. And the analogy that I make is you go to a wedding and the wedding is beautiful and the flowers are perfect and, you know, the wedding party looks amazing and the reception is, you know, the food is top notch. All of that had to be planned. All of that was done with intention.
Right.
You don't just show up there and have that all work. Same thing when we're talking about customer experience. That's exactly what we're doing is we're doing all that planning and we're structuring the events and the digital interfaces to be able to support a positive experience. Now, you can also, by lack of doing that, inadvertently create a negative experience as well. And now we're kind of on the back foot in recovery moment.
Yeah, and we've all experienced that.
That's right.
But user experience also includes the physical experience. So think of a retail environment, right?
Absolutely.
From walking in the door, from pulling in the parking lot.
Right.
To leaving the parking lot.
Yeah.
Is all user experience. Yeah.
Totally. And I would actually probably file that more underneath the service design side of things because it's user experience is going to be generally more around the digital interaction. So your store example, right? I think we've all had the experience when you pull into a store and for whatever reason, the parking lot is really dark and creepy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's off-putting. And then, or you go into the store and the merchandise is everywhere and it's not well organized or you can't see the prices or whatever. You know, examples of where I've seen organizations really increase the user experience lately. Some of the stores, like Home Depot, for example, know when I'm at a Home Depot store and they're like, hey, let me show you the store map now.
Yeah.
So if I open up the application, it says, oh, you're looking for, I don't know, I think the last thing I looked for was a drain snake to unclog a drain. Oh, it's, you know, it's in the far back of the corner of the store. Yep. Like I wouldn't have been able to find it. Go here. It's here. So they wanted me to be able to find what I was looking for as easily as possible.
Yeah, sure.
And be able to get out. So, you know, service experiences, how you interact with the people in the store, how you interact with the store itself, and digital experiences can all come together to provide that overall experience that you have.
I'd say the first time I ever even thought about that was, and I'm sure there's a lot of examples, but like QT.
Right.
In my world, at least at at the time, QT was doing something that no other gas station was doing when I wanted to get a Gatorade or something like that. It's like, wow, this is well lit. It's clean. They're nice to me. You know, it's good, decent pricing.
Right.
I'm like, this is a really
great experience.
It's a great experience that I didn't know I was missing.
Yeah. Right? And there's been a lot of conversation in recent years about the importance of the experience economy, that this is becoming a differentiator for organizations. When they do experience well, it makes people want to come back. When they don't pay attention to experience or when they do it poorly, people are like, I can go elsewhere and get a better experience. And I think customers tend to view that as part of the overall value proposition, right?
Yeah.
How hard do I have to work to give you my money?
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah. Listen, I just interviewed somebody this week who's doing, their whole business is almost around user experience. So it's cutting edge firewood. Perfect. So they do firewood at a very high level where normally you would just get a pile of firewood dumped in your driveway.
Right.
They like top-notch firewood. They deliver it. They set it up.
Stack it neatly.
They're clean.
Everything's covered.
Yes, my pleasure.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the whole experience, and they've kind of cornered the market on it. It's really amazing.
Absolutely. And people pay a premium for that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So for businesses to understand the importance and the value of the experience economy ultimately will contribute to bottom line.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that transition. So you and I worked together for the last 4 years.
Number of years.
The way, this is the first time we met in person, I think.
Yeah, I think
we've been online most of the time.
It is, yeah. I think, you know, thanks COVID. And then also when I joined RGP, I was reporting to Tracy Figurelli out of Parsippany, New Jersey.
Okay.
And our entire team, her direct reports were all virtual.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I joined RGP in 2017, I started working virtually kind of before COVID made all that cool.
Yeah. So this has been great just to meet you in person.
I know.
So we're getting a brand new customer experience here. Yeah.
New friends.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about, your journey through customer experience has been, I think I recall, product-based.
Yeah.
A lot of technology, product management maybe, and user experience and software as well. And then you came to RGP and you were doing some consulting around that too.
Some consulting internally
as
part of the innovation program, which was great because it kind of allowed us to get things up and running.
Mm-hmm.
There was rigor around it, don't get me wrong, but there also wasn't the expectation of immediate P&L on it. And, you know, one of the things that makes innovation so important when it's structured well is the opportunity to fail, right? That is part of the game. Not everything is going to work. You take a hypothesis and you begin testing and working in that direction, but there's no guarantees that it's going to work. So where you start may not be where you finish. And, you know, we had a number of ideas that we had tested out and kind of worked with along the way internally and in concert with some work that we had done with Vanderbilt University, that we said, you know what, this is okay, but not maybe what we needed at that point in time. And we were okay with the fact to say we learned stuff from that. So there was value in doing the activity, but it was okay that it wasn't generating profit or it wasn't saving employees' time, that it wasn't ultimately benefiting
the
organization on top or bottom line.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you left RGP, what, last fall?
It was about a year ago. It was March of 2023. There was some leadership changes, and I think, you know, I realized that that probably was just about as far as I was going to be able to go doing the things that I love to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And took a pivot. I filed that broadly under it seemed like a good idea at the time. It did seem like a good idea at the time, but ultimately, for a variety of reasons, that was not the right role. So I.
And what was that pivot? What did that look like?
It was consulting for a boutique firm in a very specialized area.
Still customer experience?
No, it was in the knowledge management space, which made sense at the time because I had owned the knowledge management experience for RGP. Mm-hmm. And we had made tremendous strides in that particular area. And, you know, it involved taxonomy work. And, you know, there's a lot of user experience wrapped up in both of those because when you create a taxonomy, which is basically the dictionary that everybody goes
the lexicon,
by.
Right.
Right. You've got to make sure that it makes sense and resonates with the people who are using it. So it's still very, very user experience centric.
Yeah.
But what I found ultimately with this particular organization was that you know, as very difficult as an experienced practitioner and somebody who had been working either as an internal consultant or as a client-facing consultant for the, you know, the better part of 20 years, to come in and be able to, how should I say, successfully modify behavior and expectations and manage all of that in order for both parties to be successful ultimately.
And who are those parties?
Who, for the employee, for the consultant, for myself and the employer, because okay. they had a very, very specific methodology that they used,
yeah.
which is fine and you need to have that. But when you have somebody that comes in with tremendous amount of experience, having seen the world for a long, you know, yeah. from lots of different directions for a long period of time, and not being able to utilize those experiences, it just gets real frustrating yeah, sure. for everybody.
Yeah. So when you look back at that, was that a shiny object that attracted you, or were you just running away from a situation that you didn't enjoy? What was the mix of that when you made that decision to go to the new?
That's a great question. So we had actually hired that organization to do work for us when okay. we were at RGP. And I was so impressed with the intelligence yeah. of the people that they brought to the table that I always jokingly said, hey, if anything goes sideways with RGP, I'm going to call these folks because they're brilliant. Yeah. Like, who wouldn't want to work with that level of intelligence, right?
Sure. Right? Sure.
So no, I mean, literally when I negotiated my exit with RGP, I literally sent my resume mm-hmm. to that organization and we started talking. And yep. so, great. You know, it felt almost like a fait accompli at that point in time. I was talking with other organizations because mm-hmm. I wasn't sure that the time would be right. But, you know, again, the opportunity to go work and be literally tip of the spear in that space was just so appealing, right? And I think that was probably the beginning of the transition in my mind, and I'm sure we'll get more into this, mm-hmm. of not focusing on climbing the ladder so much anymore, but kind of making that adjustment to say, you know what, I just really want to be able to develop craft mm-hmm. and yeah. get really good at what I'm doing. Now, zero regrets in the year that I spent there because I got the opportunity to work side by side with deep folks with deep, deep, deep experience in data, AI. Mm-hmm, So all of that knowledge that I gained through those experiences and coming out of it with some pretty cool client stories yeah. to be able yeah. to tell. I don't think that anything was lost.
Yeah.
You know, I don't regret that time at all. It was just, you know, it would have been nice to maybe have realized some of that risk earlier, but we'll go from there.
But so, I mean, you're alluding to something broke along the way, or you discovered something that just was unsustainable.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, my observation is this, and I'll put it in this context because I don't want to say anything overly negative about the organization. And in fact, I told one of my new colleagues, you know, hey, I would hire them to come do this kind of work again. But the advice that I gave relative to, you know, if you have in your UX organization a very rigid structure about what your expectations are and how and where and when you do things, and you are not going to bring in that senior talent's perspective and let them do what they do best.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Don't frustrate people that way, right? Because as somebody senior, particularly somebody in the UX space who comes at things from a point of empathy, I want to be able to help.
Yes.
And if I can't, then that gets really frustrating.
So what that reminds me of, and I think you and I spoke about this, the difference between working with vendors and working with employee partners.
Yeah.
And it sounds like what you're describing is it's a different relationship.
Oh, very much so.
How did that reveal itself in this?
You know, I think in this case, I think the way that I said it to you was working with people is very different than working for the yeah. same people. And ultimately where it came to a head was a very, very difficult situation, probably one of the most difficult conversations in my career mm-hmm. With my boss. And I realized at that point, okay, it's time to get my bags ready to yeah. go here and start packing. And then, you know, there, in retrospect, you know, I think this organization, I'll just put this out there. This organization had done a phenomenal job in taking folks straight out of school, with high potential and turning them into amazing consultants.
Okay.
Period, full stop, no argument from me whatsoever.
Yep.
And I think what that is because their process and their structure and their expectations could take somebody straight from school and build upon that and mold that,
okay,
right? And I think, honestly, by the time experienced hires get the experience, and it was really kind of an awkward situation because, you know, they acknowledged up front that they have difficulty hanging on to experienced hires. I see why, because it's, you know, this expectation to get in this box and mm-hmm. do things in a mm-hmm. certain way. And
yeah.
So those were kind of the inklings of me saying, I'm not sure that this is going to work long term.
Yeah.
You know, maybe start getting my parachute ready to jump. But yeah, you know, I look back at that and like I said, you know, I recommended them to one of my new colleagues the other day and said, you know, if we have needs in this area, ultimately they're the best in the business.
So you ultimately decided to leave.
Well, I was given a certain runway.
Okay.
And, you know, and at the same time, I was told you're not going to be successful at this. So, you know.
Successful here or successful anywhere?
No. Successful okay. within the context of that organization.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was honestly, right? I've been working for what? 23, I don't even know.
25.
30 years.
I counted 25 in customer service.
Yeah.
Customer
yeah. And, you know, and I had been working this long and I'm like, wow, I've never been spoken to this way
yeah.
before and I've never been in this situation.
It's harsh.
And so, you know, I think would it have been better that happened earlier? I don't know, maybe. You know, it was definitely a watershed moment for me, but it also made me realize that, you know, if I'm going to spend my energy somewhere, it needed to be protecting myself and my family. Now, that didn't say that I just phoned it in for the next 2 months. But at the same time, you know, you realize you have that watershed moment where you go, I am not going to be successful in this situation here.
Yeah.
And the
yeah.
thing is even if I had been, right, even if I would have brought in sales or revenue or whatever, you know, criteria that they were looking for, again, the respect at that point, I think, was broken.
Yeah, mutually.
Yeah. And,
sure.
you know, to be able to show up at work every day and, you know, I was a remote employee, but show up and do the things, it wouldn't have allowed me to be authentic.
Yeah.
And I don't want to live and work with that kind of conflict. So, you know, in the spirit of, listen, things happen for a reason. I had to go through that to get to where I am right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I honestly believe that in this case.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I know it, right now it's such a tough job market. So during that period of time between my last day there and my first day at my new organization, I actually spent my time coaching and introducing people and reviewing resumes and practicing interviews and doing whatever I could to help others in the customer experience place and in my network try to find their next job as
yeah,
well.
Yeah. But you were also going through a lot of changes personally,
mm-hmm.
right? And maybe you can share some of those things where you had this professional persona
yeah.
That was being challenged, right?
Yeah.
Then you had some health
yeah.
issues.
Yeah.
And you also had, you had talked about kind of, maybe it was your reaction to that kind of confrontation when we talked about imposter syndrome.
Right.
So, which makes me think, is it me or is it them? And because nobody here is telling me it's them and all I'm
right.
hearing is it's me.
Right,
so
right.
So kind of walk us through that time of your experience,
yeah.
that career.
Yeah, no, I don't mind sharing this at all because I think that it's an important message. So, you know, in full disclosure, I am 55. And I was completely unprepared for the physical and mental impacts that were going to hit me or that would hit women when they hit perimenopause. And while I was dealing with that, I actually came to be diagnosed with a latent ADHD that apparently I'd had for years, but had been able to compensate for.
Yeah.
And as
wow.
I dug into this, you know, working with a great psychologist who said, you know what, I have seen this so often in so many women when they get to the point where everything that had been working for their entire lives to keep all the plates spinning at home, at work, everywhere. Yeah, yeah. All of a sudden, all that stuff stops working and everything hits the floor. And that was honestly where I felt.
Wow.
So taking that forward now, right? You know, working through getting on some different medication, getting everything stabilized, et cetera. But what that left me with was a certain amount of scar tissue mentally and feeling like I wasn't able to trust my brain anymore, right? And it would be things like, I wouldn't remember where I parked the car. I wouldn't remember, you know, if I didn't write it down, it was gone, you know, and I was to the point where I had been Googling early onset Alzheimer's, and it was terrifying because as a knowledge worker, my brain is how I earn my living.
Exactly. Sure.
And, you know, wondering what in the world was happening here. And so, you know, obviously the medication has flattened all that out. Everything is cruising along now. I'm, you know, really feeling back to being good. However, leading into the imposter syndrome piece, when I was looking for this new job, it was terrifying because I didn't feel that I could trust my brain anymore.
Wow.
And how am I going to sit in an interview, for example, with the CEO of my new organization and not have a deer in the headlights moment? And how am I going to continue to put my best self forward?
Sure.
And so literally, I have a photo I'd be happy to share with you of what my workstation looked like that was absolutely covered with notes and reminders and et cetera. Because even, you know, I think all of us, when we get stressed, you know, it's difficult to remember things in the moment. And I was just so afraid, despite being stabilized from a medication perspective, that things were a lot better. I was still afraid that that was going to pop up again. The good news is what I found with one of the first interviews that I had, who actually is with my current new boss.
Okay.
Once I got over the initial jitters, all of that information was still in there. Right. And, you know, starting my career as a speech pathologist and realizing I hadn't had a stroke, I hadn't had a brain injury, all of that was still in there. It was just an issue with finding it again. Right. I needed to basically build some new roads to find that information again. And so it was such a lift. It was such a boost when I got off of that interview and I was like, it's still there. I am still me. Mm-hmm. And that was a tremendous moment, that I am still me realization, because I thought, you know, all of this work and all of these things that I've accomplished over the past three decades, you know, inclusive of the speech therapy work, I can't have thrown that all away. And I was so afraid that I was.
Yeah,
you know, I realized, you know, backing up when, you know, I've dealt with imposter syndrome before, terrible imposter syndrome.
Sure.
And I, you know, I think that there probably was a bit of scar tissue left over from that and an absolute, decision, you know, almost, drive to say, I am never going to let myself get back to that place again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then being placed in a similar situation because of a change in my physical composition that was beyond my control, right?
Yeah. That's really powerful. So I got a lot of questions.
Okay.
But one wraps around the whole idea of purpose.
Yeah.
And I have this thesis that a well-founded purpose can really help you carry through
totally.
A lot of those challenges. But
yes.
I hadn't wrapped in the physical implications or health implications that might challenge what you think your purpose is. So things are going fine for you, you know, 40s, whatever, going in 50s, everything's great.
And then you have this
driving
wall.
Hard through customer experience. This is my calling. I'm really good at this.
Yeah.
And then you hit an employer environment that is questioning, like, is it even my purpose to be doing this?
Yeah.
And you've got this health issue going on.
Yeah. It all stacked up at the same time. It was kind of like, right, you know, it was just the perfect storm.
Yeah.
So
that journey
stuff.
Through purpose exploration.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I would love to. And I completely support your theory on that one, that purpose is, in my experience, the greatest antidote to imposter syndrome. Wow. So to back this up a little bit, yeah, when I was with an organization a number of years ago, and again, I'm going to leave names off of this for now, but I was with a large consulting firm a number of years ago and had a very abrupt change in my responsibilities. And, you know, in hindsight, I can view it as a positive. It was a reflection in my capabilities. Listen, you did this very well over here. We'd like you to come do it well over there. But it was never communicated that way. It felt like more of a demotion in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And there were some really unusual power dynamics, both with peers and some of the leaders. And that just absolutely threw me into imposter syndrome.
And that was early on, was it?
That would have been in the, I would have been early to mid 40s.
Okay.
At that point.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, all of a sudden having that moment where like I'm in over my head, that's fine. I don't mind being in over my head. You know my hobbies, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure we're supposed to talk about that later.
We're going to get there. Don't you worry.
Right? So, I mean, honestly, I'm not afraid of much in a lot of ways. Terrified of other things in some other ways. But having that moment where I was in a space that I really wasn't familiar with, I knew that I had the skills to be able to accomplish the task that was being asked of me. But because I viewed it as negative,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't move forward. I mean, ultimately, I got done what I needed to get done, and there were very positive stories that came out of it. But that was just a really weird period in my life. And I realized, you know, again, hey, this is not a healthy place for me to be. There is not the opportunity that I thought I had here. I need to get ready to find another job. But because I was so crippled by that imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. and the feeling that I wasn't worthy to continue moving up, right? And so we're just going to stick you over here in this corner and let you do these things.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this enormous gap between what I felt I could do and what I actually was doing. And that was how I was defining the imposter syndrome. Like, why am I here? Like, what am I supposed to be doing right now? And so that was a very, very negative period. And when I joined RGP, that kind of worked to snap me out of it. I think part of, you know, all credit goes to Tracy Figuarelli on this one, who remains a great friend, who's like, I love the fact that you help me think about things differently. And that was just such a powerful affirmation.
Yeah.
You know, let me put a trademark on the end of that and brand it, right? I help people think about things differently, which is true. But sometimes you need that connection to kind of hold up that mirror to you and say, do you see what and who you are and what you're capable of here? And Tracy did that for me. And that was just so powerful. So
that's good.
You know, I filed that one away as a lesson learned to be able to apply that in the future. And I started working on purpose very intentionally and landed in a place where I can define my purpose in 10 seconds or less.
Go.
I help organizations solve communication breakdowns between groups that people often feel are too big or too complicated to fix.
Okay. I'm going to stop you there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just recently in the last 6 months that you came up with that.
No, the coming out of the purpose statement would have been in the 2021 timeframe.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So when you developed that, had your purpose kind of changed over time, or was that just a compilation of what you figured out over those 30-year career, whatever that is?
It was actually the latter. So what I realized was, and this is going to be the highly abbreviated version, is that, you know, when I looked back over the sum total of experiences and work that I completed from, you know, experiences from the time I was a child all the way up through, you know, present day career, what I realized was I'm driven by giving voice to the voiceless.
I like that.
And how that looks, and what I usually add after I give somebody my 10 second purpose spiel, is what this looks like, right? What this could look like. I can solve communication misunderstandings between brands and their customers. That's customer experience.
Yeah.
I can solve breakdowns between users and their technology. That's user experience. I can solve breakdowns between business and IT. I've done that, right? But it manifests in different ways. But it's because of partially who I was and experiences that happened when I was a child. Then, of course, you know, going into speech pathology, that literally is giving voice to the voiceless. You know, working with patients with locked-in syndrome. So for the first time since their cardiovascular issue or their strokes, they were actually now able to communicate to their families or their nurses and say, I'm uncomfortable. I need to be moved. I'm, you know, and then also allowing them to do things like change a channel on their TV. So, and then, you know, transitioning from that technology into actual technology and kind of taking off on the user customer experience angle of my career.
Yeah, that's great.
It all comes together.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to kind of redo my thesis statement around purpose and add a few more nuances.
Okay.
So thank you. But, you know, part of this, listen, part of this podcast is finding that, figuring that out.
That's right.
You know, so this is just a journey of discovery. The challenges that you faced earlier in your career, even more recently, how have they reframed the way you look and engage in relationships at work, at home, in your life?
Yeah.
Your purpose. How have those been reframed or changed?
So I think I'll start with the easy one first, right?
Okay.
As far as it comes to purpose, I think that it has served to hone and refine, right? It's kind of sharpening that blade a bit and saying, okay, this is maybe inside the lines and this is maybe outside the lines. So I think it's actually only served to strengthen my purpose and the ability that I can articulate it, right? As far as personal relationships go, I think it's strengthened and deepened them. One of the things, and I have adult children, I was talking with my son and, you know, my husband and I were both unemployed at the same time, which was obviously a really stressful situation.
Sure.
And one of the things that my son said to me, and this was so tremendously meaningful, he said, listen, you know, his sister and I, we've watched you guys grow up. And we've watched you make mistakes and we've watched you stumble and fall and we've watched you get back up every single time.
That's good. That's good.
And, you know, for him to say that, because I'm carrying all this worry, like, oh my gosh, you know, the household and the finances and, you know, shoot, let's talk about insurance and, you know, all of these realities of daily living and to have your child who, as an adult, but to have your child say, you know what, you inspire me in that way. It was full stop, just really tremendous.
Good job, mom.
I give my husband a ton of credit. And, you know, I've had similar conversations with my daughter. It's just, you know, our son is here with us. And so, you know, conversational access is that much easier. I think as far as my work thinking goes, I'm trying to remain realistic and be more, I don't know what the word is, maybe scientific or observational in terms of my expectations and saying, you know what, let me just let things happen as they happen instead of driving, particularly on that upward trajectory, but still at the same time, being all in on what the opportunity is, right? Yeah. And kind of living that duality of saying, you know what, there's a tremendous job to be done here and there's a tremendous opportunity. Let me roll up my sleeves and dig in without, I don't know if the word, without expectation maybe, of, so what does this mean? There's a job to be done and we're going to go get it done. That's what this means.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, I'm going to take a breath there. So, lot to process. All right, I want to ask you, I've got a few of your favorite quotes. No, I don't know if they're your totally favorite, but you shared them with me. But I do believe when you share a quote, it's sharing a life lesson.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to share these with you, and I want your reaction and kind of what was the context of those and what was the life lesson that you learned?
Okay.
One is acceptance is power.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So that one actually came, I was a member of chief when I was at RGP in the waning days of RGP. I was a member of chief, which is a women's leadership network. And part of that programming for first year members was cohort work, coaching and cohort work. And we would get together on a regular basis and talk about what was happening in our worlds. And part of the leadership changes and the subsequent impact on my team in general, and me specifically, was a frequent topic of conversation for me. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. one of the things that one of my fellow chief members said to me, you know, Lori, acceptance is power in this. And the sooner you can get to the point of acknowledgement that this is changing and there's nothing you can do to fix it,
yep.
right? The only option that you're going to have moving forward is to figure out how to manage within this new space, right? And then I play it forward to the situation that just happened. And it's the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when I was told, I don't think you're going to be successful here, I had that choice, right? I either had to accept, and, you know, I also believe when people show you who they are, believe them.
Yep.
You know, when I'm told you're not going to be successful here, okay, I need to accept this and I need to figure out what my plan is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
Burning time.
Yeah. All right. Next one. Kindness doesn't equal advocacy.
Oh my gosh.
Kindness doesn't equal advocacy.
Yeah. So, you know, and I think I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, I think that we've all had this experience where you work with or you work for somebody who is tremendously kind.
Yeah.
And you feel like they have your back. And then something happens and you realize that really it was almost only a veneer of kindness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when things push came to shove, they really weren't advocating for you in the way that you had thought, or probably in my case, more accurately, I had hoped, right?
Yeah,
think in so many instances where this is applied, maybe I wasn't reading the room quite properly,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right? But I think, you know, The life lesson learned here is get clear on either side of that equation. If you are working with somebody in a leadership capacity or in a coaching capacity or in a, you know, whatever, in the job market right now, making connections and referrals, then you know what? You better put yourself out there and you better advocate for these people that you're saying that you're willing to help.
Sure, sure.
And actually take action. If you are on the other side of that equation and you are hoping or requesting that somebody advocate for you, then get clear in what your ask is. How do you want them to advocate for you? What does advocacy look like from your perspective? Right? Because it's very individually defined.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't make assumptions on that one is a big one.
That's good. All right. Last one.
Okay.
Not a fit. Not your fault.
Oh my gosh. All credit to Craig Lewis,
our
former colleague on
That's
this
right.
one. You know, when everything went down toward the end of last year, I stayed in touch with Craig, who is a former leader at RGP here in Atlanta, he's a wonderful human being.
Oh, yeah.
And he's seen
Absolutely.
And done everything. And you know, he has great networking events and ideas and activities and all kinds of stuff. And that was one of the first things he said to me. He goes, Lori, you need to realize that not a fit does not mean it's all your fault.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, and I think that is so true. And I actually have had the opportunity to say that to a number of other people in real life and then also online, being involved in a lot of the professional communities that I'm in. It plays well.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, I think it's so important to remember, particularly in this job situation, in this job market, when people are losing jobs and, you know, then it's very easy to say, oh my God, I've screwed everything up. This is all my fault. You know, shoulda, coulda, woulda.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now imposter syndrome is knocking on the door.
Yep.
You know, I'm a failure and all of that. Stop.
Yeah.
Stop.
Yeah.
Right. You know, unless you've done something absolutely egregious, this probably is not all your fault.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to shift gears here.
Okay.
And that's sort of a pun because I want to talk about your hobby, which is an awesome hobby. And I'm going to put out some social media with some pictures on it so you can see all this that I saw earlier today.
I'll give you some action pictures to share too.
Great. Yeah. Okay. So talk to us a little bit about rock crawling that you've been doing for years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just tell us what all that is.
Yeah. So this actually started when I was 40, by the way. So you were never too old to start something new and crazy. I'm just putting that out there.
Emphasis on crazy.
Crazy. Yeah. So this actually started, my husband and I were competitive rock crawlers. We were professional
rock crawlers. What is that?
And what that means is that, you know, in the simplest sense of the word, driving custom-built vehicles in terrain and over obstacles that you think that's impossible. And then often followed by the next point of, those people are crazy, which is true. However, you know, what I will say, so let me just paint the picture for the folks listening. What we're talking about in my case is a custom-built tube buggy. So it has 42-inch tires. Mm-hmm. It has a gear ratio of like 153:1, which means for every turn of the wheels, the motor turns 153 times, which is very, very low.
Yes.
It has every bell and whistle that you can imagine in terms of not just four-wheel drive, but I can control whether it's front-wheel drive or rear-wheel drive or whether it's locked, which means on that particular axle, both wheels are turning at the same time, like they can't move independently,
right.
Rear steer, I mean, the whole thing. And the sport of competitive rock crawling isn't very well known. But the gist of it is you go for the weekend and there are four courses and you need to complete the course following a predefined path.
Right.
And you go through, you navigate through obstacles and you have 10 minutes to complete.
Okay. It's timed.
Yeah, it is timed. And you gain points for every gate that you clear, and you lose points by backing up or hitting a cone, mm-hmm. and then you get extra points if you complete kind of the harder gates.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the course designers will set that up to be like this big dramatic drop off of a rock or something like that. I started off-roading in my Jeep, my 1997 Jeep Wrangler TJ, when I was 40.
Okay.
And my husband was very much into this. He's former military. He was doing a lot of this. He and our son were doing off-road racing. And, as I mentioned to you earlier, I have significant control issues in situations like this. And so, and it started innocently enough as just, you know, let's go off-roading on the weekend with a bunch of friends and, you know, drive around in the woods, right?
Yes.
And then like everything else, things become a habit. So we traded up the TJ for a buggy. That was a lot of fun. Did my first competition in that. Took third place right out of the gate.
That's great.
Overcame a lot of fears along the way. And so, you know, it's funny when I look back at pictures of things that terrified me then, and I look at what I do now, and I'm like, yeah, that was ridiculous. But, you know, everything is contextually driven, right?
That's
and
right.
you don't
That's right.
know until you start pushing yourself.
Yeah.
And so it's such a great, I'm going to write a book one of these days about this. Hold me to this. On life lessons learned from rock crawling, because it's such a neat mix of strategy and tactics, right?
Yep.
Here's my strategy on how I'm going to approach this problem or course. And then you get in the thick of it and you're not where you'd plan to be. And the buggy isn't in the position that you wanted it to be. And you're like, well, shoot, now I've got to get myself out of this mess.
Yeah.
And
that's great.
So many lessons can be applied to daily life here.
Well, let me ask you a kind of a convoluted question,
because
I know it's going to have a nice story that I want to hear and learn from. So I really am infatuated with the idea or the question of grit versus quit.
Oh, that's a good one.
And it really applies in your situation, and it applies to the story you told me about that. And so, you know, there's a time where you grit it through, and there's a time where you cash in your chips.
Yeah.
And I've realized, and I've asked this question many times, that there isn't a defined framework around this.
Nope.
And it's contextual, and it's unique in each time.
In the moment.
So if you wouldn't mind sharing that story that you shared with me earlier about where you faced that question in a very visible, you know, public way and had to fight through that. Could you share that?
Yeah. And I think, you know, the way that I'll lead into this is this was the interview question that I had prepared of, where have you failed? Mm. Right. Because ultimately, this is probably my most visible and public failure ever.
And we reserve the right to define failure at a later date.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I actually won because I didn't die. So this is good. But, you know, I didn't accomplish what I had set out to do and what I know I am capable of
yet,
doing. So, yeah, I haven't done it yet, right? Yes. The growth mindset is so important. But anyways, no, I had qualified for this competition that was occurring in Utah where basically it was trails that had never been run before. It was the most challenging of challenging courses. And I, you know, there had been a lot that had gone into this. My husband and I had spent 6 weeks in Utah working remotely and practicing on the weekends, getting into all kinds of situations and getting out of them again in preparation for this. I mean, we had put a lot of work into preparing for this. The other thing that I will mention is this is largely a male-dominated sport, and I'm not sure that they were entirely... I'm not sure that everybody was entirely thrilled that I was there, but I was also the first woman to qualify for this particular event, which in and of itself was a big deal to me personally. So the day of the event came and there were 10 of us running, 10 or 12 of us running.
Wow.
The day before there had been a competition and my buggy started having transmission issues. In addition to that, there was a shift lever that allowed me to control whether or not the front wheel drive part was acting properly.
Okay.
And it was not acting properly. It would just kind of randomly pop out. So the day of this event came and we had spent the night before, my husband had spent literally the entire night trying to get the transmission issue fixed, couldn't get it fixed. Spent that morning of the event calling every place that we could think of between Las Vegas and Salt Lake City. Mm. We were in Southwest Utah at the time to see if they had this particular part or an entirely new transmission or whatever. I mean, we were just, you know, we were kind of in superhero mode. Let's do what we need to do to get this fixed, to be able to compete. And literally I showed up at the competition venue without a vehicle.
Wow.
And I told my fellow competitors and, you know, I mean, we'd been running the circuit together, so we knew each other really well. I said, I don't even know if I have a vehicle to ride right now. I don't know if I have a vehicle. So the way that this works is you basically have a certain amount of time to complete a stage. It's not like regular competition where you have to follow a predefined path. It's just literally you need to get from here to there as quickly as you can in, you know, within this 15-minute time block.
Okay.
And it's set in three stages. So the first stage, nobody made it up. All right, that's fine. The second stage required me to head up this fairly steep hill and on the top of this hill, manipulate the buggy in such a way that I could back down the left side. So I would go up, you know, I would go up this way and then I'd have to position the buggy at the top of the hill to turn it 90 degrees and then back down. And I got to that and, you know, tried to get up the hill and what it was going to be required was to really just hammer it. And get up that hill. And the transmission wasn't doing properly. The front wheel drive kept popping out. I didn't feel that I could trust that buggy at that point. And, you know, that absolutely devastated my husband because he knew. He saw it. He said to a buddy of his on the sidelines, he goes, she's lost faith in that vehicle. And, but here was the thing, you know, and the snap decision that I had to make at that point, right? And all of this is going through my head is I'm like, I need to show them that I can do this. And I need to show them that I am capable. And I need to show them that I belong here. And I need, you know, I was, that was on my left shoulder and on my right shoulder was the voice of reality saying, there is a limited amount of space at the top of that rock. And if you go off the other side, it is, and I'm not exaggerating here, a 60-foot sheer drop. And, you know, what good are you going to be with family and your loved ones and your friends if you go off the other side of that rock and you die? I mean, and I'm, you know, I say this, you know, not to be melodramatic, but let me put it this way. I mean, I have, you know, I've got the harness on, I've got the whole roll cage around me, I've got the helmet, I've got the neck restraint. I mean, I've got all the safety gear on. But a 60-foot drop is a 60-foot drop.
That's right.
And, you know, I was literally, you know, as I was trying to get the buggy up there without pushing it too hard, literally having that conversation with myself. And ultimately landed on the side of the best option, not necessarily the option that I wanted to have, but the best option in this scenario is to call it quits.
Yeah. Wow.
And to walk away from that, because, you know, if I couldn't predict what was going to happen if I got up to the top of that hill.
Sure.
And, you know, the transmission is acting up. You know, what if something jammed? What yeah. if, you know, all of these what ifs were going through my head, and I just had to reckon with that,
yeah.
that worst case, that potential worst case scenario, and decide what was best for me in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you
and
know,
for a lot of other people, your husband, your family.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing is like my sister and my aunt had flown out there and, you know, this was being cast on through the web channel. I mean, it was a very, very public failure. And I'm sure it made it easier for, you know, some of the people who didn't feel that I necessarily belong there to begin with.
Yeah.
I'm sure very, you know, it was very easy for them to justify sure. their opinions at
yeah.
that point.
Yeah.
But I know the reality of it is, and this is on the list of things to do. We haven't been back out to Utah since that happened. But the next time we're there, I'm going to go conquer that hill. That hill is mine.
That
hill is mine.
Well, listen, it took a lot of courage to, I hate to say quit, but.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it, you know what? Honestly, I think sometimes quitting is your best option. And it sounds bizarre, right? Because we're so, you know, we're always told, don't quit. You know, Jimmy V, never give up, you know.
That's right.
All of that. How about we be logical for a moment here?
Exercise some wisdom.
Yeah, exactly. And. You know I can do it. And I know the next time we go back out there, I'm conquering that hill. Period. End of discussion.
Yeah.
And I know that I can when the buggy is in fully operational condition. So if I know it, you know, and coming around to the point of saying, if I know it, then why do I need to prove it to anybody else?
Yeah.
But man, it was painful in the moment.
So many applications, I mean, just in the workplace, around all the pressure to make stupid decisions, right?
Yeah.
To either prove somebody else wrong or to...
go along with the crowd or...
Oh, gosh, yeah. Okay. Good stuff. Thank you for that.
Of
Thank
course.
You for sharing that and the transparency. Thank you.
You know what? If I can help anybody else, right? It doesn't matter how long they've been in their career. It doesn't matter what they're doing. It doesn't matter their gender, their age, any of that. If I can help somebody else and they hear in this, oh gosh, I recognize myself in that, my job is done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. Last question.
Okay.
Would you say that you've consumed your career or your career has consumed you?
Mm. Wow. That's a good one. I think, honestly, and this is going to sound like a cop-out answer, but I'll explain it. I think, actually, it's been a blend of both, and it depends on the period of time.
Fair.
You know, I think in the earlier parts of my career, I allowed my career to consume me. You know, and I think if you go back and if you were to go talk to my kids, they could probably put out points in time where they wished I would have been more available, particularly when I was in consulting roles that required a lot of travel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At critical points in their lives, right? As they were growing up, that kind of late elementary through middle school, maybe early high school, I was on the road a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I think it was easy for my career to control me then or consume me then. Now I do feel like I have better balance. And there was a very freeing moment in time. I can tell you about this very freeing moment in time where I realized that, and I said, if I got hit by a bus, I've changed that since then. If I win the lottery, you know, whatever organization I'm working for at the time will go on without me.
Yeah.
This is a reality
right.
of life. I am not the
sure.
CEO. I am not a sole proprietor.
Yep.
I am part of the organization. And I'd like to believe I'm an important part, but the reality of it is, you know, if I suddenly weren't there one day, whatever organization that I've ever worked for would go on without me. And realizing that really gave me a tremendous amount of freedom to be able to say, it's okay for me to have a balance. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah,
sure. I'm there to do my best work. I'm there to do my best job.
That's right.
I am all in, right?
Yep.
But I'm also going to speak up if we start to get to the point where, you know, I don't mind working 10-hour days for a couple of months, 12-hour days sometimes if necessary. But when that becomes expected or that becomes the norm, then we're going to have a different conversation.
Yeah. Well, that comes back to the acceptance is power.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you know that they're going to move on without you if you leave.
Absolutely.
Accepting that is power indeed.
It took a
and
lot
freeing.
Of, yeah, it was. And it took a lot of pressure off, right? You know, oh my gosh, what, you know, oh, I have to devote my life to my job.
Right. And a bit of humility. Which does everyone around you a big favor. All right, we're going to leave that there.
Yeah, we'll leave that one there.
But now it's time to go on to the lightning round.
All right. I'm so curious.
You
led this up. You're like, these are my best questions ever. I can't wait to hear these.
There's some good questions I got this time.
Okay.
So buckle in.
All right.
5 point.
Strapped in.
Yes. Yep. Here we go. Question number one. Most formative career-related book you've read?
Honestly. Okay. So this one is easy. And I actually am in contact with this guy. Don't Make Me Think by Steve Krug. It's kind of the ultimate book explaining the importance of user experience. And it's a short book. It is profound in its simplicity. We win when we create scenarios that don't force our users to think.
Perfect. Number two.
Okay.
Best family vacation ever.
I've been to all 50 states.
Okay, wow.
Depending on how we define family, my kids might be upset with me for saying this, but honestly, I loved Alaska. We were there.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, Alaska was amazing. And what I realized about Alaska is the true story of Alaska is not in how big it is, but actually the smaller parts of the story. So look down and see the berries growing beneath your feet and, you know, talk with the guy driving the cab about how he lives 200 miles north of Fairbanks up in the Arctic Circle and spends his year after winter preparing for the next winter. You know, look at the places where the permafrost has melted and there are now ponds. Amazing. Amazing. Go to Alaska if you can.
All right. Noted. Noted. All right. I think you're a professional on the birds and the bees.
Yeah.
You got bees up front, chickens in the back.
This is true. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
So if you could only raise birds or bees, which would you choose?
If I only had to pick one. Honestly, I think I'm leaning slightly toward the bees. One, because the honey is super awesome. Not going to lie.
Yes.
Even though you were here a little bit earlier when a bee got in my hair and you watched me do the dance down the driveway into the house to try and get her
out
of my hair.
We got it all on video.
Perfect. That'll be awesome. I love the challenge of the bees. One of the biggest challenges that we have to deal with as beekeepers is something called varroa mites, which will absolutely decimate your colonies if you don't take care of them.
Yep.
So there's that kind of like, I want to win against that kind of thing. That said, the chickens are wonderful and they're ridiculous. And I don't know why I didn't persuade my parents to let us get chickens when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I can buy eggs at the store. The honey doesn't taste as good at the store.
No, not at all.
There we go.
No way.
Yeah.
All right. This is left field right here.
Okay.
What's your favorite Schoolhouse Rock song?
Oh, I'm Just a Bill. I'm not going to sing it, but I could totally sing that song. That guy, you know, that little gravelly voice,
yeah.
You know, I'm just a Bill. And yeah, no, perfect. I know. And I can see it in my head. No, it's perfect. And
we love Schoolhouse Rock songs, by the way.
I love Schoolhouse Rock, followed by, do you remember this one? The Pinball Machine, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7,
yeah.
The Pinball Machine going on.
Oh, yeah,
yeah, that's my number two, even though it's not Schoolhouse Rock. Yeah, no. Get me singing that one, and we'll be singing that one all
That's
day.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. Last question. Why is Bullseye from Toy Story your favorite character?
Oh, my gosh, because I had horses when I was a kid.
Oh, that's great.
I did. Yeah, no, that's an easy one. I mean, he's just so lovable, and he actually looks like a little bit like my first pony. But, you know, it's funny you mentioned Toy Story. I mean, that was such a part of our family, particularly when my son was little. Before my daughter was born, he was kind of right at the right age for Toy Story to hit and all that. And we went to Disney before my daughter was born, and my son was almost three. and he loved Buzz Lightyear. You know, what I still remember, and I've only watched it once. I can't watch it again. But the point where Andy grows up and goes away to college I just sobbed. I mean, it was bad. My son was like, "Mom, you're embarrassing me." Yeah. And I was like, "I can't help it." You know, I mean,
it's a sweet story.
You feel that as a parent in your bones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just not a cartoon.
Yeah, no, it's all good.
Well, okay. So you're all done. You did very well. Congratulations on the lightning round. So how can someone find you, follow you, or connect with you?
Obviously on LinkedIn.
Okay.
I'm at Lori Gray. I'm also at LoriGray.com.
Great.
Yeah. And, you know, feel free to reach out. I mean, if anybody has questions or whatever, wants to talk about anything and discuss weather and bees and chickens and off-roading and motorsports and women in motorsports and all that stuff.
Lori Gray, G-R-A-Y.
G-R-A-Y. L-A-U-R-I-E. G-R-A-Y. You would think such a simple name, but there's so many ways to spell
it. That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't thank you enough for having us here. My wife is here too, so you put her up.
I got to meet her.
Gave her some mead and some pretzels, and she's
hanging out with a cat.
She's hanging out.
Yeah,
that's great. This has really been a really nice time on your porch.
Thank you.
Perfect setting.
I'm glad you all came up.
So great to get to know
you. And I'm going to send you home with honey and eggs and lip balm and all those goodies.
It's like a payday. This is fantastic.
Oh, I'm so glad that you reached out and we did this.
Yes.
So
thank you.
And you were willing to come all the way up here.
Yeah. Yeah. It was an easy trip.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Consuming Careers. If you've enjoyed the show, please click the follow button in your podcast app so you won't miss any of our future episodes. And if you have a minute, write us a review. We truly appreciate hearing from our listeners. And as always, I'm Bruce Smith, and you've been listening to Consuming Careers.